Just as a reminder, by way of invitation, this evening we will be, unusually for us, having a bit of a communion service this evening, and the reasoning is that we'll be looking at the institution, the establishment of the Lord's table, and it just seemed a shame to not celebrate that together. So we want to invite you to that. That'll be a special time this evening, a little bit extra special as a result. We'll be in Mark chapter 14 this morning, first 11 verses. As you turn there, I want you to go back to your kindergarten days. Remember when your teacher used to say, "Let's turn on our imaginations." Well, I want to do that for just a moment. Let's turn on our imaginations, and I want you to imagine that you're walking out in the country, and you have to cross a field, and it's the only way to go. But this field is filled with thorns and weeds, and you're not real thrilled about this. And so you start walking through this field, and as you look off in the distance, you see one little tiny red dot. And you think that looks as good a place as any to walk, so you start walking toward the red dot. The dust is blowing around you, burrs are sticking to your socks, and thorns and weeds are scratching your legs and arms as you walk. And as you keep walking toward this dot, it gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. And as you get closer, instead of dust, for just a moment, you catch a very faint, familiar fragrance. It's out of place. It's in contrast to the acidic smell of the weeds and the thorns. As you walk, though, the familiar aroma becomes stronger and stronger, and the red dot in the distance now comes into focus, and you walk from out of the midst of the weeds into a little area of perfectly weedless mown grass, and right in the middle is a single red rose. And you just stand there taking in the aroma of the rose and the beauty right in the middle of the field of weeds. I wanted to put this picture in your mind because the story we have this morning is a story of a rose set in a field of weeds. We might say a diamond in the middle of a junkyard, a single star on a blackened sky. More specifically, we have a story of the worship of Jesus set on a large background of the murder of Jesus. And these two happened at the same time. Mark 14, we're going to see a contrast of evil and good, a hater of God and a worshiper of God, a self-focused person and a God-focused person. We're going to see the lost and the saved, hatred and love, proud and repentant, internal bitterness leading to murder, and internal gratitude leading to worship. And these two are set right on top of one another. Chapter 14, verse 1, it was now 2 days before the Passover, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest him by stealth and kill him. For they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar from the people." And while he was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly. And she broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was the ointment wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray him. Well, let's just sort of build the scenery here for a moment. This is another typical sandwich technique that we've seen all through Mark. Verses 1 and 2 and verses 10 and 11 are very similar. And then there's an incident in between that helps us understand the meaning of the whole. Verses 1 and 2 is the plot to kill Jesus. It finally comes out in the open. It's out for everyone to see it. And verses 10 and 11, the means to kill Jesus comes out into the open. We finally find out it is Judas. Now, Mark uses a very unique setup to help us understand the wickedness of Judas. Chronologically, in the first verse here, it was 2 days before the Passover. This is Wednesday. On Thursday evening of the next day is the official beginning of Passover. At sundown, by a sundown to sundown reckoning of days, Thursday evening starts Friday, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. The Passover, as you recall, is the commemoration of the passing over, thus the name of the house of Israel, by the angel of death and the destruction of the firstborn in Egypt. Now, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they happen pretty much at the same time. They go back to back, and so that's why they're always mentioned together. So verse 10 also, then Judas Iscariot, who is one of the 12, went to the chief priests. This happens on Wednesday also. But unique to Mark, and for a purpose that's very, very useful for us, the events of verses 3 through 9, Jesus being anointed in Bethany, these are a flashback. These happened Sunday night, about 4 days earlier, the evening before Jesus rode into Jerusalem. John 12 tells us that this happened 6 days before Passover, so we're about 4 days earlier. Now, this is very useful for Mark to arrange the material this way, because his reasoning is to give us insight into the wickedness of Judas. And so he arranges the stories, and it's not an unfamiliar technique to us, so that we understand his main point. Now, verse 2, the chief priests and the scribes, they didn't want to start a riot. During the Passover, there would have been upwards of 2 to 3 million people coming into the Jerusalem and the area all around. I find it ironic that the leaders are worried about what the people will think if they kill Jesus openly, and they don't care what God will think. They're not concerned with this. In verse 3, Jesus is eating in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper. And we might put in there Simon the former leper. Number one, if he was a leper, he wouldn't be in his own house, and nobody else would be in his house. And so this was a man that Jesus had apparently healed of leprosy. And he's named because when the early church is reading the Gospel of Mark, they're going to know who Simon the leper is. And they would be able to reference a man that they know. Now, there's two in this account who are not named, but they're named in other accounts. First, this says there was a woman. A woman came. From John 12, we know that this is Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. Now, Lazarus was one whom Jesus had recently raised from the dead. And we want to be very clear, this is not the same account of the woman in Luke 7 who anointed Jesus in the home of Simon the Pharisee. Simon was kind of like Smith. I mean, everybody had that name. And so this is a different time. The Mark 14 account occurs much later. So the woman we know is Mary. There's another character or set of characters that are not named either. It says, some who said to themselves indignantly. In other words, those who were indignant that Mary had poured all of this ointment on Jesus' head. Well, we know from John 12 that there were really two groups here. There was Judas, who is the main instigator, and then there were some of the disciples who were not thinking for themselves, and Judas started this and said, we should not be doing that. She should not be doing this. And some of the other guys just said, yeah, what he said. And they just kind of went along for the ride. They didn't understand the depth of the wickedness that Judas was thinking, though. And this was very disappointing, too, because all the disciples very often had enjoyed the hospitality of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. They had been fed, they had stayed in their home, and even now in the home of Simon the leper, who's doing the serving, we know that Martha was doing the serving in John's gospel. So what happens? Mary poured this expensive ointment on Jesus' head. This was a customary thing, and we don't do this here. If you walk through the door and I dump a bottle of olive oil on your head, you're going to think I've gone nuts. But this was something you did for somebody who's been walking and traveling and their long hair is dirty and dusty. You give them a little oil, or you even anoint their head with oil to wipe away some of the dust and to give them a perfumed smell so that it made for a more pleasant evening. This was customary. But you usually did a little drop or two of a cheap oil. What Mary did was over the top. She essentially, could I put it this way, in today's terms, dumped $100,000 worth of oil on Jesus' head. She went completely extravagant. And it was said by Judas, this could have been given to the poor. Now, he's looking really righteous here, because at Passover, it was customary to give gifts to the poor during the Passover time to help their families. one's eternal destiny basically rises or falls on your view of Christ, and ultimately sides are going to be taken. All humanity will fall into two categories: those who hate Christ with furious hatred, or those who love and adore Christ with worshipful love and worship him. We might say this: the weeds and the roses. There are no other categories. What I want to do today is compare a weed and a rose. I want to compare Judas and Mary, or the saved and the unsaved. And let's start with the weeds. We want to start with those and get them over with. Judas, let me give you three giveaways that Judas is a weed. The first giveaway that he's a weed is that he devalued Christ openly. He devalued Christ openly. What did Judas think that Jesus was worth? Well, we know what he didn't think he was worth. He didn't think that Jesus was worth a year's wages of costly ointment. In fact, what did Judas call it? He said, "That's a waste. How wasteful." In contrast, in Revelation 5, the church in heaven and all the angels of heaven shouted with a loud voice about the worth, the worthiness of Christ. Here's what they said: "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." Well, we know that Judas didn't think Jesus was worth a year's wages. We do know what he thought Jesus was worth, though. Matthew 26:15 tells us that Judas was paid 30 pieces of silver for Jesus, dead or alive. What is 30 pieces of silver? Exodus 12, according to the law of God, that's how much you pay for a slave. What Judas thought was that Jesus was worth no more than a slave. Judas devalued Christ. Why does anybody devalue Christ? It's always the same reason: because Jesus doesn't fit your agenda. That's why we devalue Christ. Here's another giveaway that Judas is a weed. Not only devalued Christ openly, he used Christ selfishly. He used Christ selfishly. Judas masked his greed with a false outward concern that looked like charity. I mean, how do you argue against "we should give to the poor"? You know, you just sound like a jerk if you say, "Well, that's not right." Well, he masked his greed. John 12 reveals, by the way, that Judas was the treasurer for the 12 and for Jesus' ministry. He was the guy with the money bag, and that he used to help himself from the bag on a regular basis. If they had gotten that ointment, he had gone and sold it for a year's wages, he would have made a huge windfall. So, of course, he's irritated and upset, only for purely selfish reasons. By the way, Judas had been counting on Jesus taking power. Why do you think he was hanging around for 3.5 years? He's counting on Jesus taking power and giving Judas great position and great honor and great wealth as a result. Well, in these final days, it was becoming pretty clear to Judas, who was not unintelligent, that this was not going to happen. Jesus was going to die. Something bad was going to happen. And so the tide is turning. If Judas can't receive power and wealth and honor through Christ, at least he can turn Jesus over for a price and sell him out to the highest bidder. By the way, this is very typical of an unbeliever. An unbeliever says, "I'll trust God, I'll love God in their own way, as it were, as long as he does the things that I think he should do, things that I can understand." And the moment God allows tragedy, the moment God does something we don't understand, the unbeliever shows his true colors and turns away from God. That's precisely what Judas did. He stuck around Jesus long enough to see if Jesus would give him all the goodies that he was expecting. And when that didn't happen, he showed his true colors. He is a weed. Judas devalued Christ openly. He used Christ selfishly. Finally, Judas betrayed Christ freely. He betrayed Christ freely. Look with me again at verse 10. "Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought an opportunity to betray him." The leadership wanted to kill Jesus after Passover because many of the pilgrims were still there. But this part of their plan backfired. And it could be, I think, in God's sovereign plan that Judas convinced them that it was now or never, that this was your opportunity, that we could do it now, but it wasn't going to happen anytime after that. And we understand that Christ going to the cross was part of God's sovereign plan. And we can talk about that on a different day. What I do want to talk about, though, is that it doesn't absolve Judas of the responsibility he had in the murder of the Son of God. Let me show you this. Satan was certainly the instigator, and yet Judas is fully responsible. The Gospel of Luke tells us more. Luke 22, verses 3 and 4 says, "Then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them." So here in verse 10, when Judas goes away, this is when Satan has entered into him at this point. But there's a problem here. Later on in the chapter, and we'll look at this tonight, during the Last Supper, during the Passover meal, John 13:27 says, "Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him," into Judas. "Jesus said to him, 'What you are going to do, do quickly.'" What do we find out? There are two entrances of Satan into Judas. Between the agreement with the priests and the Last Supper, there's about 24 hours. And Satan enters into Judas. He makes an agreement. Satan leaves Judas. Satan is not omnipresent. He cannot be in two places at once. You know what this means? Judas had 24 hours to consider his actions. He had 24 hours to warn the other 11. He had 24 hours to go to Jesus and say, "I have done something awful. We've got to get out of here." But he didn't. He didn't have Satan's influence whatsoever. He had only his own conscience, and his conscience drove him to continue forward with the plan. This is very, very important for us. He betrayed Christ freely. And we want to understand this because very often it's said that God is somehow unmerciful because, as Romans 9 says, that he has created some as vessels of wrath, and that people will say, well, God is unfair. If he creates some to be saved and some to be unsaved, that's unfair. We make no mistake, every unsaved person freely of their own will chose to reject God, to reject the offer of salvation by Jesus Christ. And so God is completely absolved because he has offered salvation to all men. And we even understand grammatically from Romans 9 that those who reject, those who are vessels of wrath, have of their own free will rejected God. And so we don't ever say, well, somebody was just sent to hell from the moment they were born. No, they were given opportunities to hear the gospel and to come to faith, just like Judas. Judas was with Jesus 24/7 for 3.5 years and still chose to kill him. There's no excuse for him. Judas is the field of weeds. Now, if we closed in prayer right now, you all go home and depressed. I want to spend our time on the rose, on the worshiper of Jesus, who really is an example for us in so many ways, the ultimate focus pointing straight to Christ. Judas devalued Christ openly. Mary exalted Christ openly. Judas used Christ selfishly. Mary served Christ selflessly. Judas betrayed Christ freely, and Mary loved Christ freely. Very, very different. Let's look at the rose at Mary. She exalted Christ openly. Verse 3 again, this is the crux of the whole issue. "And while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head." An alabaster jar is a thin, delicate, opaque stone vessel. It would have had a long neck, and it had a long neck with a little skinny opening so that you would pour out one drop at a time and use just a little bit. She broke the top of this off so she could just dump it all out. It was extravagant. It was over the top. She had no intention of ever using the jar again, no intention of filling the jar ever again. This ointment, this thick perfume, was made from a plant found only in India. It was imported. It was very, very expensive. Mary is giving an extravagant gift to Jesus. She didn't care what anybody thought. Her focus was entirely on him. She didn't try to sneak up and say, "Jesus, would you like this little jar here?" She came up, breaks it off, and starts pouring it on right in front of everybody while he's at the table. It was an appropriate gift, could we put it this way, for a king. It was an appropriate gift for royalty, a gift as a token of the worth that she ascribed to Christ. It was a gift on par with gifts that Jesus received from some wise men who thought he was the king of the Jews. Gifts like gold and frankincense and myrrh. It was on par with that. We might put it this way. Judas evaluated the worth of the ointment. Mary evaluated the worth of Christ. Big difference. Judas and some of the others scolded Mary, but Jesus, ever the defender of women, he says, "Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me, a beautiful thing, literally a good thing, a noble thing, an honorable thing, a right thing." Jesus is so tender and so appreciative toward her. Judas said that could have been given to the poor, as if he really cared. But verse 7, Jesus said, "You always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But listen to this, but you will not always have me." Mary had her priorities straight. And we're going to see elsewhere in the Gospels that Mary always had her priorities straight. Jesus isn't going to be with them very long. Just a few days, it's going to be the Garden of Gethsemane, the trial, the cross, the resurrection, and the ascension. From this day, Jesus will be on the earth for 48 more days. And Mary seems to understand this and know this, and she goes all out. She didn't cave into social pressure. She didn't cave into peer pressure. Her priority was Christ. She was doing something that was unheard of. Let me put it this way. Nobody was going to stop her from worshiping Christ. Nobody would stop her. She was compelled to exalt him out of an overflowing heart of gratitude, and I believe out of a clear understanding of precisely who Jesus was. This is, as an example, the same reason we feel compelled to give financially to the ministry. You feel this overwhelming urge and desire to give to the Lord. It's a compulsion. We long to do this. But maybe a less obvious application. We desire to exalt Christ through obedience. And this is why we obey. This is the very reason we obey him. This is what Ephesians 4:1 is talking about, in walking in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called. Exaltation of Christ, which exalts Christ by doing something we might call extravagant obedience. To obey Christ with an alabaster jar, to break the top off and do way above and beyond what we would think he would even require of us, simply because we love him. Extravagant obedience. Let me put it this way. You will obey Christ to the same degree to which you value him. It's that simple. To the same degree of worth that you ascribe to Christ. In Colossians 3, Paul tells about Christian slaves and what they're to do. They're to obey their masters. And listen to this. He doesn't say, "Slaves, run away from your masters." He says, "Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men." Sincerity of heart literally means generosity of the internal part of yourself. And in other words, Paul's telling a slave, obey your master because you're obeying Christ, and do these things out of love and joy. That's a tremendous attitude to have. Why do believers want to find loopholes in obedience? Why do we want to marry our culture? You know what that does? All that says is it reflects the smallness of the worth that we ascribe to Christ, period. To the level at which you would love to obey Christ, that's how much you ascribe worth to him. You want to know how much worth Mary ascribed to Christ and how little she regarded herself? Keep your finger here and turn over to John chapter 12. John 12 is the parallel account of Mark 14. Now, to a Jewish woman, she had very few things that were her glory, but one of those things that were her glory was her hair. 1 Corinthians 11 even speaks of this. The glory of a woman is her hair. It was the symbol of her femininity. It was the centerpiece of her beauty. Long flowing hair was considered beautiful. And by the way, very, very personal. You didn't just walk up to a woman and touch her hair. I mean, ladies, what would you do now if some guy walks up and touches your hair? You'd probably punch him in the nose. Because it's personal. It's yours. It's your glory. Jesus was reclined at a low table. Mary broke open the jar. She anointed his head generously. But look at verse 3 of John 12. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. She got down on her knees, a position of subservience and of submission, and she wiped the dirt and dust from his feet and rubbed the ointment into his feet with her own hair. This was not normal. Women didn't go around dusting their house with their hair like this. This was to say, you are worth so much. And it's such a privilege to be here with you. I'm going to give you all I have. And the lower I can become, the higher you are. The less exalted I am, the more exalted you are. And she did a thing which denigrated herself so that Christ might be valued. That's how much she valued Christ. And we had a wonderful Q&A time with the ladies here at Bible Training Institute. And one of the things we talked about this past Friday night was your motivation for serving your husband, your motivation for loving your family and for doing the things that Christ has asked you to do. And we talked about the fact that the ultimate motivation must always be my love for Christ. You show me a woman who pours herself extravagantly into her family, I'll show you a woman who loves Christ, because that's what she's doing. That's our motivation. Everything we do is motivated by this. Let's go back to Mark 14 together. Mary exalted Christ openly, no shame, no fear. Second way we know she was a rose, though, is that she served Christ selflessly. She served Christ selflessly. Would you look with me at chapter 14, verse 8? Jesus said, "She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial." By the way, Jesus is affirming his upcoming death by referring to his burial. Now, here's the key for us. Jesus interpreted Mary's act of anointing him as preparing his body for burial. It seemed in some sense that Mary was sensing that things were going to go very badly for Jesus soon. There's a sense of finality to what she's doing. She gives essentially all that she has to him. Jesus said she has done what she could. In other words, there's nothing else left to do. Now, what is he talking about here? Three times in Mark, Jesus has told the disciples and those around, and Mary would have been in that crowd many times, he's told them that he would be handed over to the chief priests and the elders. He would be tortured. He would be tried. He would be humiliated. He would be killed, and he would be raised from the dead. Now, we've seen over and over again that the disciples didn't understand this, but Mary was a good listener. And in fact, we know from Luke chapter 10 that Mary was a great listener. I think it's possible that Mary believed him and took him at his word. And when he said, "I am going to Jerusalem to die," that she believed him. Now, the disciples, they still are in the cloud. They have visions of glory. They have visions that they're marching up to Jerusalem and they're going to take the throne and they're going to sit at the right and the left hand of Christ. They're going to have future glory and wealth and power. Mary had no such vision. What she sensed was that this was Jesus' final trip to Jerusalem. This was the last time we would fellowship together. She'd spent time with Jesus many times before, but this time she gives him everything she has. This is different. She goes all out. It's her last chance to serve him. Mary was doing for Jesus what would not ordinarily be done for somebody who's being killed as a criminal. Somebody who's killed as a criminal is taken off the cross and thrown in a hole somewhere. Jesus is a king, and she is anointing him as a dead king should be anointed, doing so before he died. I want you to notice the selflessness of this, though. She didn't think of the cost. She didn't think of what others would think. She didn't think of her own dignity. She didn't think of anything except having this deep, heartfelt desperation to serve Christ. By the way, for the unsaved readers of the Gospel of Mark, the purpose of this gospel, this is a perfect illustration of what it takes to come to Christ. No thought of cost. Jesus said in Mark 8, "Deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me." No thought of what others would think. We come to Christ regardless of what others think. And in fact, despite what others think, we come to him even if people are going to think we're religious freaks or whatever. You come to Christ with no thought of dignity. We didn't come to Christ dignified. We didn't come to him on eye level. We came muddy and dirty and filthy and grimy and blackened by our own sin. We came dirty on our knees, wiping away the last vestiges of our own glory, just like Mary wiped away the last vestiges of her own pride by getting down on her knees and cleaning a man's feet with her hair. And she had no thought of anything except for a deep, heartfelt desperation to serve Christ. There's no such thing as coming half-heartedly to Christ. You don't ease your way into Christ. You either jump or you don't. One of the two. You come as a humble slave or you don't come at all because you desire to serve Christ. Mary exalted Christ openly. She served Christ selflessly. She loved Christ freely. She loved Christ freely. Would you keep your finger there in Mark 14 again and turn over to Luke 10? Very familiar passage to you, even somewhat humorous. Luke 10, beginning in verse 38. Now, Mary was enamored with Jesus. She loved him so very much. When Jesus was around, everything else faded into the background. Look at Luke 10, verse 38. Now, as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve all alone? Tell her then to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her." Let me just make a couple of observations here. First of all, Mary cherished Christ's words. She cherished Christ's words. She just sat still and listened. She hung on every word he said. Martha, who I'm guessing was the older sister, got all uptight about all the work that needed to be done, and all she could think about was the fact that food needed to be cooked and dishes needed to be done. But Mary said, "Jesus is speaking, I'm dropping everything." And put it this way, if I'm talking to you and having an interesting conversation and Jesus walks in the room, I love you, but forget you. I'm going to see Jesus. And that was Mary's attitude. She hung on every word of Christ. Everything else faded into the background. Not only did she cherish Christ's words, but Mary cherished time with Jesus. You know what boggles my mind is that Judas was with Jesus 24 hours a day for 3.5 years and grew to hate him enough to murder him. Mary cherished every moment she had with him. She took every moment to sit and to listen. Why? Because she loved Christ freely, and she left all other distractions behind. Now, this was a happy occasion, but Mary's tender relationship and love for Christ, I think, is shown more poignantly in a time of grief and in a time of trial, the death of her brother Lazarus. Turn over to John chapter 11. John chapter 11. As you remember, in an act of sovereign understanding, when Jesus heard that Lazarus was ill, he delayed so that Lazarus would die. The Gospels tell us that Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. This was a family he knew well. He loved them. But he purposefully decided to allow Lazarus to die to give more glory to God and to increase and bolster the faith of his followers when he would raise Lazarus from the dead. Let's pick it up in verse 17 of John 11. Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So now, both sisters are devastated, obviously, but Mary, probably the more sensitive of the two, probably the younger as well, she is so stunned that she just sits in her house. And even when she knows that Jesus is coming, she just sits there. And she's just quiet in her grief. Look at verse 20. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Now Martha, in a wonderful show of faith in her own right, we see her interacting with Jesus. Verse 21. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. And now in the white space between verse 27 and verse 28, Jesus tells Martha, go get Mary. Go bring her to me. Verse 28, and when she had said this, she went out and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. How obedient to go right to her Lord. She expresses herself now in honest, grieving, hurting, anguished terms. But there's no anger. There's no blame. There's just love. Look at verse 32. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. In her moment of greatest grief, she did not shake her fist at Jesus. She didn't shake her fist at God. She came and fell at Christ's feet, even though he could have saved Lazarus. She loved him freely. She loved him extravagantly. She expressed her love in trust for him. As great in his example, great an example Mary is for us, she did exalt Christ openly. She served Christ selflessly. She loved Christ freely. Her love for Christ is nothing compared to Christ's love for her and for Christ's love for you. Listen to this. When Mary said this, verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Now, the English translation here is a little bit unfortunate because it sounds like that he's grieved. That's not the case. Deeply moved, greatly troubled. These are words that mean to snort with anger. That when he saw Mary weeping at his feet and seeing the death and destruction around him, inwardly he went, he was angry. He snorted with anger. He was greatly troubled. It means to be agitated, to be disturbed. Why was Jesus angry and indignant? Because he saw his precious friend Lazarus in the grave. He saw precious Mary weeping over death and over sin and over the cruel effects of sin in the world, that death had to take a young man. Lazarus was very much the embodiment of suffering of mankind under sin, something that will happen to all of us, to die. And those who love God as much as Mary did have to endure the pain and agony of a cursed earth. And Jesus is indignant that his precious Mary has to go through this. In fact, in his humanity, Jesus is so overcome by the death of Lazarus, by the suffering of Mary and Martha, by the sin of a fallen world that he bears and he understands and knows from eternity past. He's so overcome, verse 34, and he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Now, this is a word that doesn't mean loud sobbing and wailing like the people around Mary were doing. This is a word that means the silent shoulder heaving sobs of a man who is grieving something that no one else can understand. He's not just grieving the death of Lazarus. He's not just grieving the fact that Mary has collapsed in grief at his feet. He is grieving the sin of a world for thousands of years that has gone yet undealt with. But of course, in the demonstration of his love for the spiritually dying and the demonstration of his power over death, verse 43, and when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And out came Lazarus. How great was Jesus' love, though? How do we measure it? There's another way we can measure his love for us. I want to go back to Judas for a moment. Judas was Satan's pawn to get Jesus to the cross, but we have a very interesting puzzle to try to understand here. In Mark 9 and Matthew 16, parallel passages, Jesus told his disciples that he must suffer and die, that this would be for the sins of those who would come to Christ by faith. Now, you remember what Peter did? When Jesus said this, he pulled Jesus aside and he said, far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you. Did Jesus say, well, thank you for your concern, Peter. I appreciate that. He said, he turned around and said, get behind me, Satan. Now, why is Satan trying to stop Jesus from going to the cross? Well, obviously, to keep Jesus from fulfilling his mission. By the way, this wasn't the first time Satan tried to stop Jesus from going to the cross. Matthew 4, Satan tempted Jesus with fame and power and provision, and he attempted to get Jesus to succumb to sin, although in the impeccability of Christ, it's not possible for Jesus to sin. But ultimately, he's trying to get Jesus to say, you know, this isn't a bad place. And if I can be in charge of everything and rule the whole world right now, I don't have to die. I don't have to go to the cross. But now there's a change in strategy. Satan enters Judas to try to get Jesus to the cross. This is a change in strategy. It is not a change in mission, though. Now both earthly forces and spiritual forces are plotting against Jesus. If Christ goes to the cross and dies, forgiveness for sin is available, and Christ will now victoriously lead an army of the redeemed someday to take earth away from Satan, the prince of the power of the air, to consign Satan to hell. Satan doesn't want Christ to die a sacrificial death. He wants Jesus to fail in his mission. When Jesus was arrested, listen from Luke 22 what he said. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. In other words, this is Satan's moment. Now, why is Satan trying to get Jesus to the cross when that's in fact the last thing Satan would ever want to have happen? Because now Satan is pulling out all the stops. He's pulling out all the guns. The safety is off. And what he's trying to do is to throw everything he can at Jesus to make Jesus stop in his tracks. He's going to throw the heartbreak of being betrayed by a friend. He's going to throw the humiliation of being humiliated in front of Israel. He's going to throw a sleepless night with six trials. He's going to throw being punched and beaten and whipped and having his beard plucked out and having a crown of thorns pressed on his head and being mocked by those around him. He is going to throw being naked on a cross in front of his own mother. All the while each of these things is happening, Satan is saying, do it, do it, do it. Ask God to free you. Ask God to rescue you. Do it. Do it. Do it. All so that Jesus will say, enough, Father, save me now. And fail in his mission and leave Satan as the laughing prince of the earth and thwart God's plan. You see, Satan can't comprehend somebody dying for another. He can't comprehend that kind of selfless love. How much does Jesus love you? So much that in the sovereign plan of God, he said, this is the hour of the power of darkness. Satan, throw everything you have at me. I will endure for the sake of those who must be saved. That's how much. And by the way, if Jesus fails in his mission, we're lost. Instead of saying, Father, save me now, he said, it is finished. I did my work. Out of obedience to the Father and fully knowing that your eternal destiny hinged on his going to the cross, he endured, and Satan's plan backfired massively. Let's go back to Mark 14. I want to just show you one more note about Mary. See how much the Lord loves her. Verse 8, she has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And to my knowledge, no other human being has ever received this promise, which is coming true even today. And truly, I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. What a gift. Isn't that amazing? There's not one negative note about Mary in our Bible. That's very unusual for a biblical character. Using the metaphor of weeds and roses, the lost and the saved, Jesus had a warning to the weeds. Matthew 13:40, he said that the weeds will be gathered and burned with fire at the end of the age. But the weed has an opportunity. The weed who will say, I want to be a rose. I'm lost, and I want to ask the Lord for mercy and forgiveness and receive his promise. What do you have to have happen from a weed to become a rose? You have to have a transformation, right? Here's the promise to that person, 2 Corinthians 3:18. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. It is possible to be transformed from a weed to a rose, from death to life, from the image of our old master Satan to the image of our new master Jesus, so that someday, never again do we walk through a field of weeds. The field will be always all roses. That'll be a great day. Our Father, we thank you for the clarity of the gospel message in Mark. We thank you for the clear choice to either be a Judas or to be a Mary. But we thank you most of all for the example of Christ and how he is so worthy of worship. He is so high and exalted and lifted up that Mary gives us our example, that she gave all that she had just out of love for him. And I'm reminded, Lord, that we are crucified in Christ. And we no longer live, but Christ lives in us. And the life we live in the flesh, we live by faith in the Son of God who loved us and gave himself for us. Oh, Lord, we pray that you would enliven any hearts hearing this message who are still in the category of the weed, the lost, those who are headed toward death and toward consignment to hell. But Lord, you have been so merciful to allow us to breathe your air, to eat your food, to drink your water, to walk your earth, to be in your creation, and to stay alive long enough to come to faith in Christ. Might you enliven the hearts of those who don't know you. And Lord, for those of us who are your children, who are the roses, help us to act like roses, to bear the sweet fragrance of a child of God, and to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which we have been called, for the sake of Christ, giving him all glory and honor and worship and praise and might and power and wealth and worth to his name alone. Amen.